From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the Powerpuff Boy meets the Powerpuff Girls. First, we hear from RuPaul. He's not a woman, but he dresses like one. The 7'6" drag queen is the drag world's reigning diva, having crossed over into the mainstream. He appears in the new film, But I'm a Cheerleader, this time without his heels. Then, Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup. We hear from Craig McCracken, the creator of the cute but tough superheroines, the Powerpuff Girls. The girls are a big hit on the Cartoon Network. It's not easy to fit their crime-stopping adventures in before bedtime, but they manage. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Searchers are looking for two missing crew members from a Navy minesweeping helicopter that crashed today in the Gulf of Mexico near Corpus Christi, Texas. Officials say two of the crew members were rescued from a raft after the crash. They're reported to be in satisfactory condition at a Corpus Christi hospital. Two other crew members are reported dead. The Reform Party has been fractured to the point where the group is now holding two separate conventions, one for the backers of conservative columnist Pat Buchanan, and the other for those who don't want him to serve as Reform Party candidate for the upcoming presidential election. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Long Beach, California, covering the divided party.
Basically, the old Reform Party members, the original members, backers of Ross Perot, feel that Pat Buchanan has tried to overwhelm their party by what they claim are unfair tactics, and also by coming in and talking about social issues, such as abortion, which he's staunchly against, and gay rights, which he's also against. The Reform Party is officially neutral on social issues. That was done in order to get both Republicans and Democrats to come join the party. But Buchanan is a very ideological person, and he has refused to go along with that. That has really angered the old Perot backers, and that is what first led to this major split.
NPR's Andy Bowers in Long Beach. Republican presidential nominee George W. Bush campaigned today in California with the help of his former rival, Senator John McCain. Speaking at a news conference in Salinas, McCain urged his independent supporters to consider Bush. For his part, the Texas governor pledged to campaign hard in California, where his father lost to Bill Clinton in 1992. President Clinton proposed a program to cut the cost of college loans during a speech at Chicago's DePaul University today. Jason DeRose from Chicago Public Radio.
Saying not a single person should be denied college because of cost, Mr. Clinton announced an interest rate reduction and refinancing program for student loans.
All the real benefits of the work we've done together as a nation over the last few years are now out there to be reaped. But the absolute precondition is our ability to give all of our kids a globally competitive education from preschool through high school and opening the doors of college to everyone.
Some 2 million students are likely to benefit, according to the president, saving roughly $600 million in interest. In a political move, Mr. Clinton said the Republican plan of tax cuts would only benefit those who can already afford college. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 2 points to close at 10,908 in light trading. The Nasdaq lost 93 points to close at 3,760. This is NPR News. French investigators say a strip of metal in the runway probably led to the crash of an Air France Concorde jet that killed 113 people last month. Although the investigators said they still don't know the exact chain of events that led to the crash, they believe the 16-inch strip of metal punctured one of the plane's tires, sending big chunks of tire flying into the fuel tanks on the left wing and starting a fuel leak and fire. A new government report says today's older Americans are wealthier, healthier, and looking forward to longer lifespans than older Americans of just a few decades ago. NPR's Patricia Naiman has more.
The report comes from a group of federal agencies, including the Administration on Aging and the Census Bureau. It's the first in a series of studies aimed at examining national trends for aging Americans. It describes today's older American as better educated than in the past. Most have high school diplomas, and about 15% hold college degrees. Financially, only 11% live in poverty, compared to one-third who lived in poverty 40 years ago, but racial differences are dramatic. In 1999, the average net worth for older African Americans was $13,000 compared to $181,000 for whites. Health-wise, disability among the elderly continues to decline, and most describe themselves as socially active. Patricia Namond, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Fire officials in Montana say a fire burning south of Helena has grown into a very dangerous situation. The fire has forced hundreds of evacuations and destroyed two major electric transmission lines. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 12 points today. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
My name is RuPaul, supermodel of the world. I started out right here in this neighborhood. They told me I couldn't make it. They said, wasn't no big black drag queen in the pop world, and you ain't gonna do it. And look at the bitch now.
That's my guest, RuPaul Charles, America's drag queen sweetheart, from the 1995 documentary Wigstock, the movie. There's a classic line from transvestite theater that sums up RuPaul's onstage persona, if such a thing is possible. I'm more man than you'll ever be, and more woman than you'll ever have. RuPaul Charles, the man, is a lean 6'6" tall, with freckles and cropped curly hair. RuPaul, the glamazon drag queen goddess, adds 6 inches in heels and about 5 in blonde tresses, with enviable endless legs, a tiny waist, and flawless cheekbones. Through an unusual blend of showbiz savvy and positive message, RuPaul Charles has managed to bring cross-dressing into the American pop culture mainstream. He's topped the dance charts with his disco songs, hosted his own VH1 talk show, become the spokesperson for the popular MAC cosmetics line, and scored roles in high-profile films, both in and out of drag. He's appearing in the new film, But I'm a Cheerleader, a gender-bender comedy about sexual orientation. Charles plays Mike, a formerly gay man who's a rehab counselor at True Directions, a clinic for gay high school students whose parents want them reprogrammed to be straight. In this scene, Mike is called in on an intervention with a cheerleader, played by Natasha Lyonne, whose family and friends confront her with their suspicions.
Honey, we think you're a lesbian.
I myself was once a gay. Now I'm an ex-gay, Megan. I work for a place called True Directions who help people like yourself learn to understand the reasons behind homosexual tendencies and how to heal them.
What tendencies? Why would you think I'm a...
You've been trying to make us eat this tofu.
In diet, watch for a switch to vegetarianism.
You don't have any pictures of guys in your locker, just these.
Mm-hmm. These. Sexual. Even vaginal motifs in artwork and decorating. Gay iconography.
You don't even like to kiss me.
It's true.
Denial is a normal part of the healing process that we'll explore at True Directions.
RuPaul Charles, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hey.
I'd like you to describe your character, Mike, for us.
My character, Mike, in But I'm a Cheerleader, is a reformed gay person who is the male camp leader at a camp where they reform young gay kids into being straight kids. And it was fun to do because It's so absurd. I didn't mention the movie is a comedy.
I gotcha. What did the producers or the director of the film say about your role and what you bring to it, or what they imagined you would bring to it?
Well, you know, it's really a surreal look at something that could be really dangerous. You know, we're talking about teaching people or programming people to not trust their instincts or their feelings and their intuitive magic that everybody has. And that's a really scary thing. So, you know, making a comedy out of something that could be really dangerous is some touchy stuff. You know, in fact, my character Mike does what I do in my glamour drag, but the complete opposite, in the complete opposite direction, to the extreme. You know, there's a lot of crotch grabbing and spitting and posing, and that was fun because it's basically what I do in drag, just the opposite.
Now, you grew up in San Diego. Your father worked at McDonnell Douglas, and you mm-hmm. had three sisters, older twin sisters and a younger sister. It sounds like your parents' marriage was pretty stormy. Did they fight a lot in front of you kids?
Oh, yes. In fact, I was just recently writing my new bio out for my website, and I remember us, whenever they start fighting, us kids would run into the back room and huddle down in this one corner by the dresser like it were an air raid, you know. And it was interesting because when I saw The Prince of Tides and the kids in the movie did the same thing, they would actually go and jump in the lake and go underwater where they couldn't hear anything. I was so shaken up when I saw that movie. But, you know, we didn't get beaten. We didn't get... There was no sexual abuse. There was nothing like that. And when I look back at my childhood, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. It was bad. I mean, no kid should have to keep secrets and grow up in that type of war zone. But, you know, it could have been a lot worse.
What did you have to keep secrets about?
Well, you know, when my parents separated, we had to keep secrets from the other parent. You know, my mother would have it to, you know, we couldn't tell things that she was doing to my father. My father didn't want us to tell her things. And then we had to keep secrets from the social workers because we were on public assistance, and there were things that my mother didn't want the social workers to know about, you know, whether she got some extra money babysitting or that kind of stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And immediately, when a kid is brought into that situation, you're taught to... you know, you can't be a kid anymore. Your innocence is gone, and you have to start keeping secrets. And it's the same within this movie. When you're taught to not trust your instincts, when something wrong is really happening, and you ask your parent, "Mommy, something, what's wrong?" And your parent says, "I'm fine. Everything is fine." You then your instinct is really thrown for a loop because you know instinctively that something's wrong, but you don't trust that because the person you trust is telling you, no, everything's fine.
Now, when you were little, people mistook you for a girl.
Yeah.
What did they see there that made them think that?
Well, I was a cute kid is what I saw there. You know, I was a beautiful, beautiful kid. So, yeah. But, you know, a lot of little boys... A lot of little boys are mistaken for girls. I grew up in a house full of girls, so I did have feminine characteristics. But that didn't really end until I was 15. It probably had a lot to do with the fact that I had this huge afro. So, you know, and, you know, I was a cute kid and sweet disposition.
Now, San Diego is not exactly a black town. How racially segregated was it there?
Well, you know, it's taken me years of therapy to be even able to say I'm from San Diego because I don't have an emotional attachment to San Diego. It's a beautiful place, lovely, clean air. Kids can have an age of innocence, at least when I was growing up there. But I never found my place there. You know, it's very Republican, conservative, very white, and very segregated. A visitor may not see that. But growing up there, you know, you really get it. And I really didn't hit my mark, I felt, until I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, when I was just turning 15. Around that time, I moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And then I thought, okay, I'm home now. Because there's a mixture of people, and there were definitely more brown-skinned people there. And generally, people are warmer in a more sincere way. In San Diego, as with, I think, all of California, which is where I live now, there's a superficial niceness that I've never been able to buy, you know. Even as a kid, I knew there's something behind that smile that's not so cute.
So when, as a child, did you first start experimenting wearing women's clothes?
Well, you know, my sister Renata tells me that I used to dress up in one of her, this pink dress of hers when I was 5 years old. I don't remember that, so I'm going to take her word for it. But, you know, because my mother was such so rebellious, I never felt confined to blacks here, whites here, boys here, girls there. I always felt like I was a visitor from another planet, visiting this strange land. And yes, they were backwards and really idiotic at times, but you know, I'm here for the visitation, and it's just a short ride, so let's cool it. So I always used all the colors in the crayon box, and there was never a sexual connotation attached to it. I dressed up as a cowboy. I dressed up. I was having fun. You know, there was never any sexual thing attached to it, the way other people attached a sexual perversity to it, something subversive.
Did you dress up as a kid and put on shows?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was one way for me to get my mom's attention. You know, I love the Carol Burnett show, so I would do all the performers on her show, like I would do Charo and Tina Turner and Little Richard and Elvis and anything I could do to get my mom's attention, and she loved it. She loved it. It took her out of her own drama for a minute.
My guest is RuPaul Charles. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. RuPaul Charles is my guest. He's best known for his performance as RuPaul, supermodel to the world. He's a drag performer and actor. He's a former VH1 television talk show host.
And I can bake a cherry pie.
And all that and more. And he's a singer. You left home at 15, and you moved in with one of your older sisters and her husband in Atlanta. And at that time, Atlanta really did have this burgeoning gay scene. Was that your first exposure to real drag culture?
Atlanta, yes, definitely. When I was about 12 in San Diego, my sister, who was always fashion forward, had a picture framed of the disco star Sylvester. And the picture she had was of him in drag. And I remember asking her questions about it, and she said, well, he was in a group in San Francisco that I probably can't say the name on public radio, but it was a very famous group in San Francisco. And then he branched off during the disco years to become a solo artist and create a name for himself. And that was the first time I realized they were actual drag queens, not in the Milton Berle, Flip Wilson ilk, which were just comedians making fun of women. This wasn't making fun of women. This was like, you know, a political statement saying, you know, you're not going to tell me what I can do, what I can't do, and that this is about being as beautiful and fun and having fun with all the toys in the playground.
Were you already out in terms of your sexuality?
I've never really been in the closet. Never was. When I was a kid, I think I was probably maybe 5 or 6. The people, kids in the neighborhood said, you know, you are a sissy. You are really a sissy. And I didn't know what that meant then, but I knew that that meant that I wasn't what they were doing. I was different. And so it never really was. I never really had to have that big conversation with my mother or my father. Although I did have a confrontation with my father when I was 17, because he had heard, it's a weird story. My sister Renee, who's older than me, said, you know, Daddy's going to want to talk to you because he says that someone told him that they saw you hanging around with these people that they knew were gay, you know. So Daddy's going to want to talk to you. So I said, fine, you know. And so we went and we talked. And I told him, you know, he told me the story. And I told him, you know, it's really interesting that you would come around and talk to me about this now when at other times when I really needed you to talk to me and tell me, give me guidance, you weren't there. But for this, you want to come and talk to me for this, you know. And this is this was 1977 when we had this conversation, and you know, I was feeling no shame about being who I am at all, you know.
So you were in Atlanta in the 70s. What drag style was in vogue then?
Well, what drag style was, you know, the gay rights movement was in full swing, and everybody was having a party. And I remember going to a club in Atlanta probably around the time I was 17, and I saw a drag queen perform a Donna Summer song. And I couldn't believe that was not Donna Summer. I thought, the only way I knew that wasn't Donna Summer was that this Donna Summer's legs were really long and gorgeous, and she danced around a lot more than Donna Summer danced around. And I was gobsmacked. I was just amazed. And Atlanta is, the whole South is always celebrated eccentricity, and it was just applauded. I moved to Atlanta and enrolled in the Northside School of Performing Arts, which is a magnet school for the public schools in Atlanta. And I was around a bunch of other kids who thought and had views as I did. And it was the first time I really felt like I was at home. The Atlanta, I call it like my bar mitzvah, which was when I sort of came into bloom as a human. I felt like I was doing hard time in San Diego before that.
The first time you appeared in full drag, what did you wear?
I wore, professionally, you know, I've always, ever since I was a kid, I always considered myself hippie, punk, you know, nonconformist. So I always dressed differently and had fun with it. So, so it's hard for me, and I consider drag everything you can put on. You know, I think you're born naked and the rest is drag. But professionally in drag, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, in a band, and we decided it was a punk era, so we were doing sort of a smear on the Reagan 80s, and we just would wear, you know, combat boots with smeared lipstick and raggedy old wigs and stuff. And the first time was just for show gimmicks, and everybody the girls in the band dressed up as guys, and the guys in the band dressed up as girls. And, you know, it was all for laughs, but everybody looked at me and said, Miss Girl, you got it going on. Look at those legs and all this stuff. And I remember thinking, And there was a file open in my head thinking, you know, this is interesting. It wasn't until many years later I knew that I could really do something with this, and that it could be my thing that I really take to the umpteenth degree.
What was then the inspiration for the super glam look, which you embody now? Were you just following the trends in transvestite culture?
Well, what had happened was after I'd become a big fish in a small pond in Atlanta and created a name for myself. And then in 1987, I moved to New York because it was time. And at that time in New York, I had to start at the very bottom. And the call for work at that time was go-go dancers who were drag queens, who could look, you know, sexy. And I'd never done that sort of sexy thing. It was always for laughs, you know. So moved to New York, needed the money, so I started go-go dancing on the bar at the Pyramid Club in the East Village.
On the bar? Literally? Mm-hmm. On the bar? Were you in a cage?
Yeah.
Or just on the bar?
No cage. It was just, they'd have you know, drag queens and sexy boys, and anybody who looked freaky would dance on the bar, and you get $40 a night. And to make up for my $40 a night, I was a very good go-go dancer. It's not even about the dancing, it's about the attitude and how many connections you can make with people while you're up on the bar or the go-go box. So I would walk out of there, I'd get my $40 a night, but I'd end up having $120 in $1 bills from tips. And none of the other people would get tips. But I would, lick my finger and just, I would do attitude dancing. I was, posing, and I'd say, come here, what's your name, you got some money for me? Come on, baby, give me a dollar. You know, and I would make money, so.
Sure.
That's what happened. And a few years in New York, I became very popular and became the Queen of Manhattan, which is an annual award the downtown club people would give to a guy and a gal. Could be a guy gal or a girl guy, it doesn't matter. But there'd be a king and a queen of Manhattan. And I was crowned that in 1990. And after I was crowned Queen of Manhattan, after my year was up, I decided, okay, well, I've just did the pinnacle of underground club world in New York. Let's go above ground. And what happened was, I thought, well, to go above ground, I'm not going to be able to do it in drag. So I decided to do my androgynous look and go out and perform and get a demo tape together and go out and perform. So I did that. But everywhere I went, people would say, I love the show. When are you going to start doing, your black hooker look again? When are you going to do your you're the fiercest drag queen alive. When are you going to do that? And then it dawned on me. It was like an epiphany. I realized, what am I doing? I am the fiercest drag queen ever. Why don't I just get into drag and then turn the volume up to 45? I love in that Woody Allen movie, I think it's Stardust Memories, where the aliens visit him. And he says, well, what should I do? What should I be doing with my life? And they say, you're a funny guy. Make funny movies. As simple as that. I was a fierce drag queen. Become an even fiercer drag queen. So that's when the Glamorama, Glamazon drag came in. I thought, okay, well, before my look had been black hooker, which was sexy, trashy, I decided to take it to the umpteenth degree and do couture clothes, do blonde hair on brown skin, do really beautiful makeup like from the magazines, and just make it perfect. And I set my demo tape out with those pictures, and voila, I got a record contract.
RuPaul Charles will be back in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the crime-stopping adventures of Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup, three super heroines who make up the Cartoon Network's The Powerpuff Girls. We hear from their creator, Craig McCracken. Also, more of our conversation with drag diva RuPaul. Just in time, the Powerpuff Girls, fighting crime, trying to save the world. Here they come, just in time, the Powerpuff Girls. Oh, look, it's a man's fuzzy love things, watch out. Remember the pulse, it roars, roars, get him. It's evil, Jojo, Jojo, chasing evil like this car. Fighting crime, trying to save the world.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with RuPaul Charles, actor and drag performer extraordinaire. Charles appears as a man in the new film But I'm a Cheerleader, a comedy of sexual disorientation. Part of RuPaul's allure as a drag diva are his fabulous good looks. We wondered about his beauty secrets. RuPaul, your look is so utter glam femme. It involves, I imagine, a violent amount of makeup and work to get it right. What does your routine involve?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I'm a drag performer, but I think anybody who's ever stepped on stage, actually any civilian who goes to some office building in one of those suits with the sneakers is in drag. And it's for me, in my life, I've been able to look at our culture from an interesting perspective, and we're all doing the same things. We're all kids playing dress up. And, it's easy to say, it's obvious that I'm in drag. I'm dressing up in, quote unquote, women's clothes. But we're all doing it. I'm sitting right now talking to you in a Prada suit with some gorgeous red, I think these are Valentino shoes, and it's a man's suit. It's everything is all masculine, but it's total drag. It's total, like, I'm playing dress up, and I love to do it. Any woman who's in show business, from Cindy Crawford to Sharon Stone, she would have the same amount of makeup and people and clothes and stuff and paraphernalia that I would have. It's just that our culture, it's easy for us, for everybody to say, oh, well, see, there, he's in drag, and it takes him 3 hours to get ready because he's a drag, because he's a man. Honey, everybody who does that amount of clothes and makeup and stuff, 3 hours, even more, hair, makeup, lip liner, contouring. I don't care if the girl is 17 to 55, it's going to take that amount of get up and go.
I believe you. I want you to give up the goods, though. I really want to know how you look so fabulous.
Well, and it's bone structure, darling. There's a ton of tricks, and they're not just drag tricks. They're tricks that every glamour girl knows, and it's they're passed down through the ages, you know. But people say I dress up in women's clothes. Women don't dress that way. Only drag queens dress that way, whether it be a male drag queen or a female drag queen. You know, Sharon Stone is a drag queen, and people laugh at that, ha ha ha. But it's the truth. It is the truth. It doesn't mean she's a man. It means that she gets up into drag. This week I'm appearing on VIP. I'm taping it this week, and Pam Anderson and I joke about, you know, who's doing more drag than who. She's
well,
total
well,
drag
you're,
queen.
You're really up against your match with Pamela Anderson.
Hello.
But I have to ask you, do you wear a corset?
I do all the, I'll do whatever, by any means necessary. You're not going to get a straight answer out of me. I do it all.
Come on, you give it to Liz Smith. Why can't I get you to tell me?
Well, yes, I do. I wear corsets. Not because I need one, because I'm rail thin, but I wear it because it gives me that extra edge. It gives me anything I can use to take it to the umpteenth degree. I'll do it. I haven't done any type of surgery, and I probably wouldn't. It doesn't mean that much to me. It's not that important to me. Corset. I'll use tapes to tape to give myself tighter skin. You know, I it's hard to describe what tapes are to a civilian, but every glamour girl knows exactly what they are. You basically tape your face back to take out certain lines and to give more definition in places. Mm-hmm. You know,
how do you create cleavage?
Well, you know, it's not rocket science. You basically, you get a push-up bra, I'll give you the secret. Men have pectoral muscles, and if those pectoral muscles are squeezed together, they look like cleavage. So if but you have to have on something tight to hold them close together.
You also use something called tucking panties.
I knew you were going to get to tucking panties. Well,
got to get there.
You remember the old Taco Bell campaign, run for the border. Well, basically, you take your business and you tuck it to the border. And so that you have a fierce tuck going on. If for civilians, tuck means you you flatten out your crotch area. That's a pretty picture, isn't it?
Yeah, sounds a little painful. I mean, all of it, well, not just the last bit.
Well, glamour is pain. And because we're talking about the idea of glamour, glamour is a man-made idea that, you know, that our culture worships, you know. If you think about it, the men created these shoes that are so high like that, I guess to make women's legs look great or longer or whatever, but she can't walk in them, she can't run away, she's totally, you know, the corset, she can't breathe in them, so you're basically, you know, powerless. And the way drags do this thing, it's making fun of that.
RuPaul Charles, thanks so much for talking with me on Fresh Air. It was a fun ride.
Thank you, Barbara.
RuPaul Charles. He's in the new comedy, But I'm a Cheerleader. He's also the narrator of the new documentary film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Coming up, Girl Power. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Now it's time to meet the girls who are saving the world before bedtime.
Sugar, spice, and everything nice. These were the ingredients chosen to create the perfect little girl. But Professor Utonium accidentally added an extra ingredient to the concoction, Chemical X. Thus, the Powerpuff Girls were born! Using their ultra superpowers, Blossom, Bubbles, and Buttercup have dedicated their lives to fighting crime and the forces of evil!
The Powerpuff Girls, the hit cartoon series on Cartoon Network, has an audience with an unusually broad demographic. A lot of boys and grown men like it for the rock'em sock'em action and gags reminiscent of the old Batman cartoons. Girls and women appreciate the girl power message of the show. Here's a scene from the show. In this episode, the professor, the girl's creator and father figure, has just come home from a date with the suspiciously sweet I'm a Good Lady.
Wake up, girls. I have a surprise for you.
Excited to be helping out around here with you girls.
Helping out? What?
Well, girls.
Why don't you let me explain to them?
Oh, okay. Sure.
Alone.
I'm at your command, Ima.
Oh, you. You see, it's quite simple, girls. With the professor being as busy as he is, it'll be good to have a female touch helping out around here.
But we don't need any extra help around here. We're the Powerpuff Girls!
And it is that kind of attitude that is going to change around here!
Uh-oh, something is amiss. Or maybe even soon, a missus the next morning.
Come on, girls! Townville's in trouble!
And just where do you think you're going?
We're going to fight crime! That's what we do! Duh!
My guest, Craig McCracken, is the creator of the Powerpuff Girls. The show originally premiered on Cartoon Network as a featured short by an up-and-coming animator. McCracken admits that the initial idea for the girls had little to do with girl power.
Basically, it was a student film of mine that I was doing at the California Institute of the Arts, which is they have an animation program there. And I have always been a big fan of superheroes, and I just kind of wanted to do a superhero genre film for my second-year student film. And I had happened to draw this drawing of these three little girls, and I just liked that initial contrast of, like, these cute little innocent-looking things but being really tough and really strong. And just by the nature of the contrast, they seem even tougher and stronger. So it kind of just stemmed from that initial idea of that student film. And then, you know, I just thought it was a fun, cool idea.
Were they initially called the Powerpuff Girls?
No, they were initially called the Whoop-Ass Girls, which, you know, I like a little better because it just is, it's cleaner as a, of a concept because, you know, the professor used sugar, spice, and everything nice and accidentally dumped a can of Whoop-Ass in. And it just fits a little more with that whole kind of theme. But, you know, for obvious reasons, we had to change it to Powerpuff.
And we all have Whoop-Ass lying around our labs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, he does.
Now, you worked at Hanna-Barbera out of college mm-hmm. as an art director, and you pitched them the idea. Mm-hmm. What'd you call it, and how did you describe it? How did the pitch go?
Well, basically, I had the second-year student film, and I just heard that Hanna-Barbera was looking for new shows. And so I just took them my film and said, okay, this is what I want to make. This is the show. So I just played them the tape and told them, you know, the initial story, and they said, this is great. We need to do something with this. We don't know what, but we have to do something.
Hanna-Barbera did test Powerpuff Girls with kids. How did it go over?
Well, when we made the first short, at the time, like Cartoon Network and Hanna-Barbera were pretty psyched on the show. They thought this was going to be the first one out of the gate to go to series, and it was like the number one, at least in the executives' minds. And you know, I went to this focus group with 11-year-old boys, and I was in this room with all the presidents and the big shots and the suits at Hanna-Barbera, and they played it, and the boys absolutely panned it. They just said it was the worst thing they'd ever seen in their life, and one kid stood up and said, you know, whoever made this cartoon should be fired. And so I'm in there with the president of Hanna-Barbera and just, like, totally crushed and destroyed. I had no idea, like, it would have that venomous of a reaction. I knew they might not like it, but I didn't think they'd despise it. So it was pretty interesting, and it kind of made Cartoon Network and Hanna-Barbera think twice about, like, oh, maybe this isn't the right one to launch our original programming with.
Well, how did it ever get made after that?
Well, over the years, a lot of viewer response kept just people calling in going, why aren't you making this show? You know, why aren't you producing this as a series? You know, you've got this great thing here and you should do something with it.
Let's talk about the look of the Powerpuff mm-hmm. Girls. They've got these perfectly round heads and no fingers.
Right.
Explain that.
Basically because when I drew them, the first drawing of them was really tiny. I drew them really small. And so when I was drawing them, you know, I didn't want to get too much detail into it. And I just drew this little kind of graphic shape of this little girl. And it did something to me. I mean, it worked. And I didn't want to mess with it. And I, as I would draw them over and over, I'd go, okay, let me put fingers on because obviously I'm going to need them. But it didn't look right. There was something that just wasn't working with it.
Now, there are obvious references to Batman. The mayor in the Powerpuff Girls calls the girls to help fight crime, not on a red phone, but on a preschool one with a face on it that I remember from my childhood.
Yeah, and definitely the mayor's office is actually a complete swipe from the mayor's office from Commissioner Gordon's. Like, basically video printed it out and gave it to our BG guys and go, this is where his office is. And it's a subtle reference that most people might not pick up on, but it's the same room. I hope we don't get sued by 20th Century, but, you know, I just kind of did that as an homage. Because the thing that I really loved about that show, you know, it was probably my favorite show when I was a kid, and I was watching it with total seriousness. It was real. Whatever was happening to those characters was serious. And my parents were watching it and completely laughing, and I used to get really upset with them because I thought they were laughing at me because they thought I was watching a dumb show. But when I watched it when I was older, I realized the whole thing was a joke. And that was kind of a major source of inspiration for me, trying to find, wanting to make a program that can work twice in a person's life on two completely different levels, but it's the exact same program. So where there's subtle, more ironic adult jokes kind of sprinkled in there that kids might not be picking up on, but there's also this kind of base of just good action and fun entertainment that, you know, kids can enjoy.
The plot usually deals with something that little girls really do get motivated by. For instance, standing up to a rich princess spoiled brat or dealing with your divorced dad's new girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
That's an episode called Mommy Fearist.
Yeah.
Or being afraid of the bugs.
Yeah.
In an episode called Insect Inside. And in that episode, the villain is this masterminding roach. How do you come up with the storyline?
Basically, what we do is you just sit back and you go, okay, what did we do as a kid? What were things that affected us? And how would I have dealt with that situation if I had superpowers? And if you ground it in reality like that, it really helps, I think, make the audience relate to what's happening. And a lot of it is like, okay, classic thing, kids being afraid of the dark. Well, what if the villain was actually the boogeyman and he was this disco guy who wanted to block out the sun so he could party all night? And so you basically just start with something, a foundation that's based in reality, and then add the concept of superhero-ness on top of it.
When you were a kid, did you spend a lot of time thinking about what you'd do if you were a superhero?
Yeah,
being
pretty
a superhero?
Much. Yeah, my mother made me like capes, and I would basically wear it every single day. I had a black cape with an SC on it for Super Craig, and I kind of wore that every single day of my life. You know, I just liked it. I don't know why. I wanted to be a superhero, I guess.
There are a bunch of evil characters in the cartoon, mm-hmm. a whole cadre of them. Right. My favorite, and I think most people's favorite, is Mojo Jojo.
Yeah.
The name, you know, it's just brilliant.
Thanks.
He's some kind of warped, mad scientist monkey in a mm-hmm. turban with a very strange pseudo-Eastern European Arab accent and a penchant for redundancy, as mm-hmm. his name would suggest. We happen to have a Cartoon Network commercial featuring Mojo Jojo. It spoofs a popular network TV show. Let's listen to it.
You do have one lifeline left, Mojo Jojo. Would you like to use it?
Mojo must think about this. Or if I use this lifeline that is my last, then I will have no more lifelines. And that will mean that in the future, when I might want to use this lifeline, then it will no longer be available to me, as I would already have used it now when you asked me if I wanted to choose to use a lifeline.
Perhaps someone you'd like to call.
Call? Yes, call. I could call someone on the telephone, and it would ring at their house, and they would pick it up, and then I would ask them the answer to this question that I am thinking about and unable to answer on my own, despite my superior intellect and desire to...
Where did Mojo Jojo come from, creatively speaking?
I'm always a big fan of monkeys in general, so monkeys are always good in any form of entertainment, wherever you put them. But he was basically... Just I wanted to have a catch-all evil villain that could be their main nemesis, who could either be kind of goofy, kind of silly, or really evil if need be. And he was just a drawing I did in college of this evil monkey with this glass dome over his head to protect his brain. And the initial concept of Mojo is that mentally he's like three steps above man, you know, humans, but physically, he's three steps below them. So he's still kept down on the evolutionary chain, but he's frustrated because he's much more, you know, far mentally advanced than any people are. So he hates the human race, and especially the Powerpuff Girls, and he's always just trying to destroy them. And he's just like a good classic arch-villain evil guy. And his dialogue is basically like an homage to Speed Racer, where, you know, a lot of that dialogue was done because there were so many mouth shapes in the old Japanese cartoon. They just had to keep talking when they were dubbing it in English. And so they just had to keep, you know, reiterating the same thing over and over again because the mouth was still moving. And it kind of accidentally became this really amazingly funny kind of thing. You know, the Speed Racer cartoons are some of the funniest cartoons unintentionally that I've ever watched. And so I kind of wanted to do that with a character because, you know, most villains usually always declare their evil plan beforehand, and I just thought it would be funny if he just kept doing it and kept declaring it. And as far as his accent is concerned, I don't know if it's any kind of ethnic stereotype specifically. I've read things where it is Middle Eastern or it's Japanese, but we never said do that. We just said do this dark, menacing voice. And the voice actor who we were auditioning came up with this, and it was like, oh, that's him.
My guest is Craig McCracken, creator of the Cartoon Network series The Powerpuff Girls. We'll be back with more after the break. This is Fresh Air. back with animator Craig McCracken. He's the creator of the Powerpuff Girls, the hit cartoon series on Cartoon Network. I'm curious how much of the animation is drawn by hand and how much by computer in the Powerpuff Girls.
All of it's drawn by hand. None of it is drawn by computer. It's all still traditional cell animation. We do the storyboards and all the preparatory work here in the States. All the boards, all the models, all the sheets, all the backgrounds. We send the blueprints over to Korea, and they animate it by hand, and it's all shot on, you know, on film. It's classic traditional animation. And even if you're using a computer, you still have to draw it. There's still a guy sitting there drawing what's going on. There's this misconception that there's this magic computer that you push the Make Cartoon button and cartoons come out, but it doesn't exist.
More than half of the audience share for Powerpuff Girls are boys.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, what do you think the appeal is? The violence?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not sure what cartoons they were watching when they were growing up. But when I was growing up and I watched the Super Friends, the superheroes never fought the villains. You know, they would like catch the Joker and tie him up and throw him in jail, if that. I mean, because there was rules about violence and stuff, and so there was never any conflict between good and evil. And I think the boys are really responding to the fact that, hey, look, there's bad guys being bad, and here's the good guys coming in and actually being good guys and saving the day. And there's some visceral action that they can pick up on. You know, I think they like that.
When did you start drawing?
I was about 3. I started drawing. Probably my first drawings were Mickey Mouse, Batman, Superman, things like that. You know, I've always been obsessed with the graphic image. My mother used to tell me that when I was about, you know, 2 or 3, I used to just stare at drawings of Mickey Mouse and just I couldn't take my eye off it. You know, just because it was I just liked the image of it for some reason.
Your mom was an art teacher.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Did she teach you to draw?
No, not at all. My mom, was basically a housewife for the early part of my life. And then my father passed away when I was 7, and she kind of had always wanted to be an artist. And so later in her life, after my father passed, she decided to pursue it and became got her master's in art. And so, now she's a teacher. When I was growing up, she wasn't. But she was always an artist. She just never had an opportunity to really explore it.
So your dad died when you were 7. What mm-hmm. did he die of?
An aneurysm of the heart.
So it was sudden?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Do you, 7 is pretty old. You must have pretty strong memories of coping with that experience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's probably the main thing that really pushed my artisticness a lot, because I kind of just turned inward and decided to just start drawing. Because a lot of what I did is, when I couldn't draw something, I would have an image in my mind and I couldn't draw it the way I wanted it. I would go to my dad, and he had studied architecture and was an engineer, so he could draw fairly well. And so I would kind of direct him and go, okay, I want this drawing of Batman, Superman, and Shazam. I've never seen that image in any of these books that I have. I need to see that image. Can you draw that? And then I would tell him what I wanted him doing. Because, you know, the way my hand was doing it, it wasn't matching what I could see in my head. And so when my dad passed, there was really nobody else to do that but me, so I had to kind of force myself to draw even better so I could get the images that I had in my head out. And I kind of, you know, that's when I really, really got into just, you know, drawing at full speed.
I've seen plenty of articles theorizing about the feminine and the post-feminine message of the mm-hmm. Powerpuff Girls, and I'm sure yeah. the irony isn't lost on you that right. that there is all of this philosophy about this show and about girl power, and it's a show made by you, a guy who mm-hmm. just loved thought these little girls were really cute when they were fighting.
Right.
Does it make you, I don't know, do you feel a little bit weird when you come across these theses on the show?
Somewhat. When people are saying it's intentional, like it was all pre-planned, it is a little strange, because it's not. It just kind of happened that way. I don't know if subconsciously the reason it's happened is because I was raised by my mother, so I'm used to strong female role models growing up, or, you know, I don't know where it comes from. But if you look at the show, all the girls, all the female characters in the show are pretty positive, and all the males are basically idiots. And it was never intentional. It just kind of happened that way. You know, where Miss Bellum is really smart and intelligent and helps the girls out. Their teacher, Miss Keene, is the same way, but all the villains are male, and most of them, and they're fools, and the professor's really kind of strange, and the mayor is obviously a complete idiot, and I don't know how that happened. It just kind of, it happened that way. I'm not, you know, it was never pre-planned. It just was an accident.
Now, did my eyes deceive me, or do I see in the episode Mommy Fearest about the professor going out on a date with a real hot, I'm a good lady, that's her name, woman, that they're stuffing condoms in his pocket as they're helping him to get ready?
Well, you never see them. You just see Buttercup's hand in his pocket and, you know...
And she says, some of these.
Some of these. So they could be handy wipes. They could be condoms. You know, who knows? They could be breath mints for, you know, all anyone knows. It's kind of left up to your imagination. Whatever you think it is probably what it is.
To have fun, do you throw in little risque numbers like that?
If it works with the story and it kind of doesn't get in the way of the narrative we're trying to tell, yeah, we'll put it in there if we find it funny. We don't try to do it intentionally, like, oh, we have to have something... you know, to put sneaky to put in this episode. It's never something that, you know, we have to do for sure. If it happens and it works, then we'll leave it in.
Craig McCracken, thanks so much for talking today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Craig McCracken is the creator of the Powerpuff Girls. The Emmy-nominated show airs weeknights at 8:30 on Cartoon Network. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Joan Tuohy-Westman. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Book Division, publisher of Dr. Murray's Total Body Tune-Up, Slow Down the Aging Process, Keep Your System Running Smoothly, Help Your Body Heal Itself for Life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Ravi Shankar and his daughter Anushka. She's been a student on the sitar since she was 9. She has a new CD. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.